All right, guys, good to have you back. Gary, we're going to jump right into this one. We've lost power 3 or 4 times today.
And we got one in the bag.
We got one in the bag, and so we're going to try to shoot for at least another one, maybe two. Something we brought up in the last podcast just less than 5 minutes ago that it's a good dive for us to do. And
We think it is.
It depends on
which one of us loses support out of this.
We don't want it to backfire, but actually, we're not accusing anybody per se. Yeah, yeah. We're not accusing anybody. We're asking you to evaluate yourself.
No axes to grind. We're not thinking of anybody.
No. And the thing is on this, sometimes you don't realize it until it's brought to your attention. So this could be just a friendly encouragement to evaluate your process.
Yeah.
So let's jump in, Gary.
Yeah. You know, we had mentioned why wouldn't pastors embrace this idea of having more than just the preaching as part of your process to bring people to spiritual maturity in Christ? Why wouldn't they? And I guess what I was thinking is, you know, I think, man, there's probably several reasons. I think some of the reasons I'll throw out, this might sound brutal. I'm not trying to elevate myself as in this, you know, this humble brag that I'm some, you know, humble dude. And so everybody else.
Yeah. You guys aren't saying you guys aren't cutting the mustard.
But I think that, you know, we've been conditioned for so long, as young guys in the ministry, as we grow up in the ministry, that, you have to be the fount of instruction, that the preacher has that responsibility. Mm. Okay. Well, yeah, he does, the preaching from the pulpit does sort of set the course of the church. I would agree with that.
If
the preaching is going one direction and the ministry is going the other, it's not going to work. It's a house divided. The preaching sets the course, okay? But what I would say, what we've been saying, is that how you bring somebody to spiritual maturity is not exclusively by what happens in the church services.
Absolutely.
That there should be time outside of that where people are getting together. So for us, we related in that last podcast that we basically have 3 meetings that we're calling people to. Now, you know, you have more people that will come to the service than that will come to small group. But you're trying to work people from that big base that comes to the church service to the small group. And then from the small group, you're always trying to get people to go to that next level of discipleship.
Well, and to jump in there on that, generally it's from the relationships built on the first level that kind of encourages them to go to the second level. It's by coming to church and building the relationships and the coffee, the fellowship we have afterward, just standing around talking to people that friendships are struck up.
That gives them a taste of the small group.
And
just
then,
a taste.
Yeah, but it also gives the person who's in the small group to say, hey, you ought to join our small group.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying? No. So that first connection point is great because it's non-confrontational. It's just an easygoing kind of thing. You come to church, you listen to the sermon, and you just chat with somebody afterwards.
Yeah.
And then through that chatting, all of a sudden somebody has, dude, you had to come hang out with us. We have this thing, there's food and fellowship, and we just sit around. It's not super, not formal. Mm-hmm. You don't have to talk, but you can talk, you know. And somebody goes, cool, I think I'll try that out.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then when they're there, like what happened, like I was sharing in the last podcast, somebody shares a testimony, somebody shares something from the Word, and they get encouraged in their own life. That can have an effect, which is what you're going through in your small group now, where now it's like, hey, we need to get together and talk about. And so now you're getting a deeper, more intimate just with these couple guys that are wanting to really grow in their faith. And like we were saying in the last podcast, it works its way back up. Now they're commenting on the messages seem to be more relevant to them. The messages haven't changed.
No.
It's that their hearts have changed.
Or sensitized to it, yeah.
And so why wouldn't people want this sort of dynamic? And so I think one of the reasons is that we're still stuck in a mode. Sometimes pastors are stuck that it has to be me that's doing it. I think there's pride that can be involved in that. I'm not accusing all people. I think some people, this is the way it's done.
I would throw 2 divisions in that. I think there's a lot of traditionalism that we don't recognize as traditionalism. That is the way they were taught. And they just don't know how to think any other way. And I don't mean that as a bad thing. It's just like, brother, this is how you do it. And this is how you do it. You know,
it may be because that was effective in their time.
Sure.
And for their particular life. It's just like somebody that gets saved. I mean, I've seen this dynamic. If somebody is saved through the work of a bus ministry, sometimes they become passionate that we've got to have a bus ministry.
Yeah.
You know, because they were saved through that bus ministry or through a sports ministry. We got to have a sports ministry because this is what, you know, and
this is the only thing God uses.
Right. Basically. And yeah. That's the attitude they can have. And although it may not fit the demographic or the time or the,
right.
you know, the,
right.
and so they're pushing something. It's just like, and I heard a pastor talk about this out west when I was on deputation. He said, the guys from the East Coast come here and we all know they're going to last less than 5 years.
Yeah, because they crash and burn.
Hey, they crash and burn because they come with from these huge ministries. And he was talking particularly about independent Baptists.
Yeah.
He was an independent Baptist. And he said, they come from these large churches that have in that day, I mean, look, I've been on the field 20 years, so I'm starting to season now. But, you know, 20 years ago, it was still a big topic about bus ministry.
Yeah.
And so he was saying, you know, these guys come out from the East Coast. They have a large bus ministry, and they come out here to Kansas and Wyoming, and they think they're going to build this huge 1,000-member churches on bus ministries. They're going to run buses. And he was like, we're a small community. I mean, we're a small community of ranchers.
Yeah.
And so the way you make inroads to people, number one, you're not going to have thousands coming. You're not going to be running hundreds of buses on your bus route. And he said, so these guys come out here and they want to build what they saw back home. And they're not recognizing the context and the way that you reach people. And so some people that, you know, if they were saved in a particular ministry, they think, well, that's got to be the way. And that was just a method that was just a vehicle,
tool.
Tool.
Yeah. You know, I believe it or not, I used to have a cowboy hat and a belt buckle and a pair of Roper boots, the lace-up cowboy boots. I worked at a camp in Utah for 2 summers and honestly thought that was how God was leading me. And you're absolutely right. You're totally right. You cannot bring your Eastern ideas out west. In fact, to me, it's much more like actual mission work out west. I hate to say it that way.
Yeah.
Because there's a couple who, when I went out west for the first summer, the first night I got there, we went horseback riding with them. And we would at different times with the guy I was working with at the camp. I worked at a camp out in Utah. We would go to their house and just do whatever, help them do stuff, whatever. If they needed to buck hay, we went over and bucked hay. And it was not fun. It was hot and sweaty and nasty work, but that's how we opened up conversation with them. Now you go over to their house and you get invited in and there's the beer cans and the cigarettes sitting on the coffee table and you just got to keep your mouth shut. You know what I'm saying? And so to me, you're absolutely right. But what it came down to is just a personal investment taken out of your time. You show them that you love them. You don't just talk about it, invite them to church and send your bus by to pick them up because they're not going to. But believe it or not, that couple surrendered to Christ eventually. It took a while. And he went and pastored for a while.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I flew into Wyoming one time. And I remember the pastor came and picked me up. And he was in blue jeans, work boots, and a leather bomber type jacket. And so he apologized. The first time, he's like, I'm so sorry. I was on the roof of one of our church members.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have time to go change. I hope, you know, and I was like, oh no, that's fine. But I'd never had that happen before. Every time before either. But here's what's interesting about that. Many times, if you're on the East Coast, they would have sent somebody. The pastor himself came and picked me up.
Yeah.
Now he didn't have the khaki pants on and the collared shirt and the polo or the tie or anything like that, which would tend to happen on the East Coast. Because why? Because he had been out on the roof of the person. He had lasted there. He had started as a youth pastor, and then something happened, and so then he became sort of that reluctant senior pastor. The people loved him because he just, like you were saying, like mission, he just identified, this is how...
People.
The people. And so this is how I'm going to do it. And so it's not going to... I have to be contextualized how I'm going to do that. And so I just think it's a good, you know, as we talk about, you know, why don't people... you know, want to do these small groups and do the discipleship. I think sometimes you're right. It's tradition. It's tradition. It's just got to be, it's just from the pulpit. I would say today that people drive by your church, if you're in the United States, And they don't think there was a time when there was a recognition by the people that, hey, the church has some spiritual answers. Mm-hmm. Now there's people that drive by the church that they have no clue. They've never been in church, or they got burned by church.
They don't know the lingo. They're
hurt by church. They don't know the lingo.
Or the dress code.
It's just a building with a big parking lot that sits empty all during the week except for one day
and
a week.
And probably or even Wednesday think night, that it might maybe. Be something that indoctrinates people in a wrong way.
They see no relevance and no connection. Now, am I saying sell your buildings and don't have corporate worship? Not at all. And some, I think that's sometimes the frustrating part is when you try to encourage people to think about allowing people to do small groups. Well, 20 years ago, I remember in this movement, of course, small groups have been around before 20 years, but I remember, you know, knowing some churches that were going through that process of starting to think, hey, you know what, we can let people, but then it was like, well, you can't let them go off campus. And when you would talk to the leaders, one of the reasons was that'll cause the church split. Well, I mean, so what's underlying here? And so now we go back to a discussion about discipleship too. So what type of leaders do you have, and how are you forming those leaders that you literally cannot trust them outside the property of the church? I mean, if that's the case, then why aren't you living on a compound?
Right.
And you just lock everybody in, because I can trust Deacon Joe Monday through Saturday off the church, but if Deacon Joe has a small group on Tuesday night at his home, he'll cause a split. That goes to a deeper
thing. So you've gone from
thing.
Tradition to pride now because somebody feels threatened because they're building their own kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, very simple. My father-in-law taught me this years ago. It's the simple evaluation, but you can walk in a short amount of time and you can evaluate and you can realize. And my father-in-law says, he says it to when he's witnessing to unbelievers, he says it to believers, he says it to pastors. You're either building one of two kingdoms. You're either building God's kingdom or you're building your own kingdom.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, out of insecurity, we want to protect ourselves, or we're afraid that. I had a transition in Venezuela that has totally affected the way I do ministry. And it's not, I'm not soft on doctrine. I'm not any one of those things. I just realized it's not my job to change people, nor is it my job to chase people. Okay. Now, please understand, I will invest to minister into you. I'll go to your house. I mean, we discipled people in their homes. They invited us over for dinner. In other words, I have no problem with making that investment, but I can only minister to you as much as you allow me to minister to you. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? I can't force change. Walter and Julie, perfect example. Julie got saved. My wife started discipling her. She kept this huge notebook of stuff that Sarah was discipling her. Walter was a little bit more reluctant. Walter supposedly gave his life to the Lord, but for months, we go to their house and we have pictures of Mary, basically, the Vina Pastora, they call it in Venezuela, all over the wall. I go to the car and every week I'm like, what should I do, honey? I think I need to say something. She's like, let's just pray. Let's just let God handle it. Let's pray. Next week, oh, honey, I think we need to say something. I couldn't change Walter. I couldn't change Julie. I couldn't change that. Guess what, though? Showed up 1 week, no more pictures of Mary on the wall. They decided to paint a picture of a tree and put their pictures of the whole family on there, and they were excited about it. What's the point? No matter how much you try to, let's call it, rule with an iron fist or whatever, you are not going to change people. They might conform to sit under your preaching, and they'll sit in a chair and fold their hands and wear the right clothes, but you're not going to change their heart. When I learned that in Venezuela, I just learned that I just need to be a big arrow that points to Jesus, whether it's in evangelism or whether it's discipleship. I can't change you. That's not my job. And if I try to, you might change for me. But that's not changing for the right person. And I realized that there's a potential really for more damage if I try to get them to change for me, because they're going to change when they're around me and they're going to change when they're in front of me. But what they do on their own time, and we've seen it in churches over, 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 when the cat's away, the mice play. Mm-hmm. And so, but if I make them responsible to Jesus, even my boys, I got rules in my home. We got rules we operate by. Okay. I can have this iron fist and everything can roll like it's supposed to roll when they're in my presence. But the minute I walk out the door, they're going to do their own thing.
Yeah. And there are churches that are still operating from everything has to come from the pastor.
Yeah. And so I would say too, the other thing that was a relief for me once I understood this concept in Venezuela is that your obedience is not incumbent on me. In other words, God does not chase me because you're disobeying. In other words, I don't love you any less. I'm going to pour my heart into you. I'm going to disciple you. I'm going to teach you. I'm going to preach to you. I'm going to do everything I need to do. But if you choose to be disobedient, then I can't fix that. Now, if it's dividing the church, if you're hurting your family, certainly as a friend, as a believer, I'm going to come confront you. And there might even be church discipline involved if it's something that's doing harm, okay? Mm-hmm. But the idea is not that I'm going to chase you down and you're going to obey me. The idea is, hey, you're doing damage to the other believers and we need to deal with this. You see what I'm saying? It's still looking towards reconciliation. It's not looking towards condemnation. It's looking toward reconciliation. But once I understood that, then I don't want to sound soft. I'm not, but I'm like, I'm not the Holy Spirit. I don't want his job. That's his job. I cannot change people. I cannot put you under conviction.
Yeah.
I cannot manhandle your life and make you to do everything you're supposed to do. And if I can, it scares me a little bit because that makes me responsible, because unfortunately we do have some churches where pastors have created codependency on them. And it's really kind of a Baptist Catholic kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
It is. I mean, if we could, let's borrow a page. Let's illustrate this, okay? Probably a lot of our listeners watch, let's think that they watch some sort of sport. Let's use football.
Okay.
Can you imagine that the only coach that can train that team, now on football you have offense, and then even within the offense you have a line. So you have a line, you have running backs, you have receivers, you have a quarterback. Okay. In the defense, you have the secondary, you have the line. Okay.
And then you know more than I do about football. Okay.
Yeah. But you have different positions that there's,
right.
They move a certain way. They block
based on what their position is.
Based what their position is. And then you have special teams, you know, the field goals, the punting, all that. Now, can you imagine a football team that everybody receives their instruction and their teaching just from one guy?
Yeah.
He calls the plays on offense. He calls the plays on defense. He calls the plays on special teams. He coaches the line. He coaches the running back. He coaches the receivers. He coaches the quarterback. Now, in a general way, yes, the head coach is responsible for all of that. But what does he have? He has coaches. He trains. He's got an offensive coordinator. He has a defensive coordinator. He has assistants. He has a line coach. He has a running backs coach. He has a quarterbacks coach. He has special teams coaches. He has assistants to those coaches. And what does he do? Is he's empowered them to work in those specific areas to bring the team philosophy. This is how we're going to run offense. This is how we're going to run defense. This is how we want to do special teams. This is how we want to block. This is how we want to run downfield. Here's how we want to do the plays. And he empowers those leaders to do that. Now, another level that's even from beyond that is when players grow up in that system and they're allowed to make changes on the field based upon what the coaches have taught them, and they're entrusted on the play to say, you know, let's call an audible here because the defense is lining up here, and I've been taught that when they line up in this formation,
we need
to do this, and so I can respond and not just go to the we got to run the play that the offensive coordinator said, because it doesn't matter that they're going to tackle me 10 yards behind them. I can see that this is not going to work out. I'm entrusted to call an audible that'll be put us more successful because I've been trained by my coaches. That, in a nutshell, is a very simple explanation of what a football team is structured as far as the coaching. Why isn't churches like that? That it just comes from the head coach. The head coach is still, the pastor is still responsible, but you empower your coordinators, and then you empower your players on the field. And I would just say this, we're all players. And so the illustration, with any illustration, there are limitations. Okay?
Sure, sure.
I'm not trying to say this is a perfect illustration, but that's what I see small groups doing. Jason, when you're meeting on a small group, I know that you have the heart of what our church is doing. Yes, we're going to have different styles, and we're going to have our different preferences and our different things.
We do. Okay? We do, because I freaked you out a few weeks ago, and I was like, yeah, our small group usually runs from about 4 to about 8:30. You're like, whoa.
Well, dude. It's like, what are you doing? I mean, I'm just trying to save your marriage, dude. No.
We love it, believe it or not.
You love it, and that's your thing. You know, mine was in and out in an hour and 15, but we prayed, we rejoiced, we hugged, we ate, we did it. But it's adults.
It's just your personality.
It's your personality. And it works, and they're growing. And you can see the fruit of that. The point is that when you're meeting on Sunday night, I'm not worried that you're stealing people away from the church. I see this as we're on the same team. Okay. We bought into the same, we're part of the same church. And if I'm, if you ever see me talking to your guys, you're not scared that somehow I'm trying to rip them away from you or trying to create some sort of wedge between me and you. And I don't understand why other pastors can't embrace it. And it's just like, well, if they're going to divide, they'll divide. Deacon, I mean, you do that, man, you'll just divide. The quickest way to split a church, have small groups off side campus. That's the quickest way to split a church.
Really? Yeah, I think you're admitting then you have a very unhealthy environment if you're that fearful.
If you're also admitting that the people are not as spiritually mature under your system you're claiming.
You might need to do some discipleship work before you, in other words, you may not even want to think about small group. You need to do some personal discipleship first to make sure these guys are solid and are heading the right direction if you're that worried about it. Because if it's there's two dynamics there, because there's a loyalty. You know, you have to be so careful, but there is what is called covert narcissism. And unfortunately it rears its ugly head. And we've done the podcast about it in the church quite a bit. And it's just, it's insecurity that needs me to be reaffirmed by people, but it's to the point where it's unhealthy because there must be an absolute loyalty or nothing. And I've seen that played out in a missions context. I've seen it where there's an inner circle of loyal people. And if, you know, but the minute you confront, the minute you're not 100% in agreement, the minute something happens, you're out. You just left the inner circle. You're going to be I'll find a way to get you out of that inner circle, because all I want is people who are in the inner circle to be loyal to me, period. And that is such a dangerous thing, because it's a vicious circle of feeding into that covert narcissism that says I need to be the, you know, there's some deeper issues there, I think, if you can't get past that, because I think traditionalism plays into it quite a bit.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a traditionalism is pride. I mean, there could be that, but what it I'm could saying, be is that you just don't know any other way.
Gary, have you ever been to country churches, though, where they're just like, well, I'll tell you what, my pastor told me, and this is just the way we do it here because my pastor taught me. Okay, that's traditionalism. It's just he's never thought outside that box. It's just he was told that, and he followed it. And sure, in that process, he feels good about it because everybody's following him, but he doesn't see it's just the way he's been taught. Because I would say first would be traditionalism. I would say second would be pride. And you know how I always pull this back in, but I think third is discipleship, because I see a generation of, I want to be so careful when I say this, but people who don't know how to think biblically. They've never been taught to walk through. They get their convictions from the pulpit, not from the Word of God. Mm-hmm. And a really backlash of that is we have now a generation with weak consciences because they don't know how to discern spiritually how God speaks and talks to them about certain things. They don't know how to go to the scriptures and discern what and listen to the Holy Spirit. I tell my small group all the time, guys, listen, be careful. God's going to work with each one of your hearts in different ways at different times. Just because he's a little bit more strict on you in a certain area doesn't mean you come to church and tell everybody else they need to go do what you're doing. I said, because it's not always black and white stuff. So be careful, because you're admitting and showing everybody you're the weaker brother if you're offended by everything. Just because God creates a conviction in your heart doesn't mean, I think there's a big thing that's got to be dealt with that's so scary to me. And again, it goes back to that thing I said in Venezuela is I would preach. Now, I had a small congregation. I have 200 people or 300 people like we do here. I had a small congregation, 30, 40 people. I printed 30 or 40 copies of my notes every week.
Handwritten?
No.
Oh, okay.
I sat down in a little bench and I gave, I gave it in a very talking style because we were in a house. We were basically in a living room.
Yeah, it was appropriate to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I shared it that way and I said, hey guys, listen, God's working with me on this thing.
Yeah.
So I need you to know this is not because I think I've got this figured out. Second of all, I'm going to give you my notes because I'm going to give you what I feel like God's taught me.
Yeah.
Guess what? I've done what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
I've shared with my heart. I've tried to do due diligence to the study. Now living it is up to you. Mm-hmm. I can't control that.
No.
And I think that's where we need to get is why can't we delegate? Why can't we entrust things to other people?
Why can't we empower people?
That's what God did. And the funny thing is, because in your description was kind of funny, it's really the description of God's sovereignty. Mm-hmm. There's an errant description of God's sovereignty that I think is an errant description. I'll be careful, yeah. but it's like God has to be in manipulative control of everything at all times, or he can't be sovereign. No, God is sovereign, has absolute control, can do whatever he wants to at any given time. But Correct. He, all throughout the Old Testament, delegated, New Testament, delegated authority and responsibility to yeah. people. It didn't change his authority structure at all. He just empowered them to do what he asked them to do. Adam and Eve, perfectly. They had dominion and authority in the garden to name the animals. Do you think God couldn't name the animals? He's sovereign. He could, yeah. but he chose to delegate that to Adam and Eve. He also chose to delegate the gospel to the Jews. They failed.
Yeah.
So what did he do? Well, he shifted to the Gentiles. He tried to. He gave him the opportunity. He delegated the responsibility. They didn't follow through. So he had to move on to plan B. Matthew 23:37, Jerusalem, I would have gathered you as a hen would gather her chicks, but you would not. Did he give them a choice? Did he allow them? Did he try to delegate that to them? Absolutely. They refused. So that principle of delegation is all throughout our walk with God.
And you didn't use a word, but I mean, tied to that is free will. I mean, true right. love has to be a choice.
That's what I'm saying. When you only defined sovereignty as, I'm scared to use the word, but it's the one that describes it for me the best, manipulative control, right. like preordaining, not foreknowledge, but foreordaining, then you got to make God guilty for a lot of stuff that I don't biblically see that he's guilty for. But if I see him as delegating under the umbrella of his sovereign authority, but yet he gives me responsibility. Because I always give I lived in Venezuela. I gave the illustration. I always said, if Nicolas Maduro walks into the room, okay, if he walks in here right now, and this is Venezuela, does he have the ability to shoot and kill everyone in this room? Well, he's a dictator, so yes, he does. Mm-hmm. Okay. If he doesn't, does that change his status as a dictator? No, he's still a dictator.
Right.
He still has the ability.
Right.
He could whenever he wants to. He doesn't walk in the room a dictator, and because he didn't, now he's no longer the dictator.
And in that sense, he retains the authority.
Bad illustration, but the point is, he's no less Nicolas Maduro when he walked out of the room than he was when he walked in.
Right.
He doesn't have to express it to his fullest extent to prove, and within that, he can, and the funny part of that, too, is if he was to do it, he probably wouldn't do it himself. He'd probably delegate somebody else to do it anyway. So I see that pattern through Scripture. God continually looks to delegate responsibility and authority to people, whatever the case may be, whether it's in the Old Testament through through creation, through
Israel,
through prophets. I mean, you think of all those things. Right. He's delegating a certain responsibility and job.
Right.
It doesn't mean he can't accomplish it, because I mean, you look at Jonah. Jonah messed up big time. You know, he got cranky when things didn't go the way he wanted them to go, and God still accomplished his will, even though Jonah messed up. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, he delegated responsibility. Jonah kind of he ran it first, but then he came through. But even at the end after that, he kind of lapsed back into his poor me kind of thing. And this is our enemies. So he really didn't do what God wanted him to do, but God still accomplished his desire. God delegated it. So
it should be reflected then. It should be reflected in our churches. That idea, because unfortunately, right. a lot of times in traditional, it's not reflected. It's like everything rests with the pastor. I'm not negating, and you're not negating that the pastor has a responsibility. Pastor has, we'll couple that with authority.
Okay? Right, I mean, right.
We're not saying that that's not there. But why is it that nobody can receive a lesson except through the pastor? And is that healthy? And if you can't trust Deacon Joe, I'm just throwing out a name. You can't trust Deacon Joe to have a small group in his own house because he'll split the church.
You got to do some serious investing.
Then Deacon Joe shouldn't be a deacon.
Right.
Because Joe is not spiritually mature enough and doesn't have the qualifications of deacon. And so see, all of a sudden, it really is a reflection on the fact that you're really not bringing people to spiritual maturity, or your ministry is not bringing as much as you think that the effectiveness of the... Now, is there a potential? Yeah, there's a potential.
There's always
a potential. There's a potential people can create division sitting in your church services.
Well, let me go a step further. I'll go a step further. I guarantee you, as you turn people loose, I guarantee you they will make wrong choices or wrong decisions.
There will be some that will go out, and then you will have the uncomfortable situation where you have to pull them in and you have to say, hey, you're out of step here. And it's not, I am not saying, no, you just let everybody, I mean, I'm not saying, Jason, you got a small group and you decide that you're going to just start, I mean, you're going to start lamb blasting what we're doing as EBIM, and you're in disagreement with this and that and this, and you're communicating that to your group and you're just kind of doing your own group. Well, what's my responsibility? Yes, I still retain the responsibility as pastor to come in and, Jason, this is not where we're not. How can two, as Amos said, how can
two walk together unless we agree?
Unless they're agreed.
Right.
Yes, there may come points where you have to have uncomfortable conversations.
You will, but that is part of that discipleship process. Maybe some will do it on purpose. Maybe some will do it by accident. Maybe you'll get wind that somebody's teaching something that's not doctrinally correct. So you got to circle back around and take them back under your wing and disciple them and show them without telling them that they're dumb and stupid and heretics. Maybe it's an honest mistake that they made. Maybe somebody else had influence over them that taught them a certain way. You know,
you're reaching people just looking at ours. Now we have several small groups in the church. And instead of, see, if they were coming on Wednesday night to get just one lesson, they would be hearing one person.
Sure.
But now we've got, the church has several teachers that are out there.
Right.
If you look at it as a fishing operation, do you want, if you're in charge of a fishing operation, do you want to have one net? Or would you rather have several boats with nets out in the waters?
Well, it depends if you feel threatened by the other nets. And that's the issue we're talking about here. Because I know what my philosophy of it is. We are working together to make disciples. I know, I've dealt with you, you're humble. I can come to you with a different idea.
Don't make me prideful.
No, I'm just saying we can interact. You and I have slight philosophical difference on certain things about how they play out, but we're okay with that. We can, you're not dictating how my small group is running, and I'm not coming to every church service telling you exactly what you need to teach either, because there's a certain amount of trust and liberty that comes into that. But I see, for me, that was that mentality of, it's not my responsibility to be the dictator here. It's not my responsibility to constantly just be on top of everybody, making sure everybody's pulling the line, because there's a sad side of spiritual codependency that we form. And we also form spiritual immaturity, because those people, and that's what I'm saying, even going to the next level of discipleship. So we have a generation of people who went to church, but to a certain extent, don't know how to fight their way doctrinally out of a wet paper bag, because all they've been, their discipleship has only come through from the pulpit. Their convictions come from the pulpit. So literally they're spiritually codependent on the pastor.
Yeah.
And if there's no pastor, they're not going to grow, because they don't know how to feed themselves. If you teach people, like, you might even disagree with this a little bit, but, you know, we're studying Revelation, my small group, can be kind of a controversial book. There's a whole different hermeneutical approaches to
yeah, sure.
Okay, there's a literal, there's a figurative, and all that kind of stuff. But even on some of the stuff, I have told our small group, guys, if we come into something, I'll present to you the two different theories. The three different theories. I will tell you why I believe personally that I choose this theory, because, you know, I said, but ultimately it's your responsibility to dig in, look at the same scriptures and see if you come to the same conclusion. Because we fight and divide over that kind of stuff as churches, and we only have fellowship with other people. But what is the point? The point for me is to get them interested in studying the Word of God, get them interested in digging deep, get them interested in knowing God on a deeper level, and then applying it to their lives. If all they are ever is dependent upon me to give them the answers, here, give me the sheet and I'll read over it, they're not going to ever internalize that. They're never going to apply that to their life. And so I try to kind of dangle that piece of meat out there and hope they get interested in it. That's my philosophy of SEMCA. That's my philosophy of all that. I'm going to share with you why I believe. I'm going to give you the biblical reasons. But you're the one who has to come to the ultimate conclusion, because you answer to him, not me.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I can't think of exactly the right phrasing of it. But, you know, when you're talking about pastors with empowering other leaders, it goes back to on essentials, unity. You got to have unity on essentials. You're not at all saying, oh, yeah, well, if your leader doesn't believe that, that's fine. Just let them lead a little group. No, on the essentials, there's got to be unity. On some of the non-essentials, there's liberty. And like what you were talking about, you know, how do you interpret every little thing in Revelation? There can be a little bit of a difference.
Sure.
But in all things, charity or love.
Right. And this is, for instance, I think it was Swindoll looked at his stuff and he was like, don't lose yourself in the book of Revelation. Remember, this is the revelation of Jesus Christ. This is who we're learning about. It's about him. Don't get lost in all the semantics and the perfect interpretation of what this means, because, hey, let's be honest, there's probably a lot of mystery, and if people say, oh, this means this country and this means that. Okay, great. I'm okay with that you maybe come to that conclusion. I'm not going to teach it as doctrine.
But that's not the main thing.
Right. But the main thing is we're in total agreement on inspiration of scripture, number one. Right. Number two, that this is about Jesus and about who he is, and this is at least about the future, how we get there. We might take this slightly different path to get there, but that's okay, because I want to teach them how to have a relationship with Jesus, not how to parrot what I teach them. Because if I make them spiritually codependent upon me, I've not made a disciple.
Yeah. I think another perspective or paradigm to think about too, and this is what Paul lays out under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 12, you know, we're all part of a body. We've all been gifted. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when you really accept that and you can realize that, wait a minute, you know, sometimes there could be differences, but maybe it's not so much differences as it is just strength that's part of this. In other words, I need, let's say for me and you, I need Jason's perspective and his points because he balances me out. If everybody is just, if all I'm hearing is I'm in an echo chamber, if all I'm hearing is what I've come to believe.
What we call yes men.
Yes men, or only my viewpoint. I'm in an echo chamber. I need to hear a balance on some points. And actually, it's not necessarily, I mean, what about if it's this, Jason? Is it possible that it's not that you're right or I'm right, or that you're wrong or that I'm wrong, but together, we need each other's. We need it because there's like a tension in a wire. You need tension on this side. You need tension. I'm not tension negatively. I'm talking positively. Your perspective on something, on a particular issue, and my perspective maybe are both right, but it's like a mixture. The compound has to be together to work.
I'll give you a perfect example. Perfect example. I had something I was teaching in SEMCA. And I approached you and I said, hey, have you ever heard this approach to this thing before? And you said, yeah, I've kind of seen it before. You know, I'm kind of somewhere in the middle on it. I don't know what to say. I wouldn't make it an absolute statement either way. And you said, you know, and I said, would you have an issue if I presented it in SEMCA? And you said, no, not at all. I would prefer that you would prefer, you said, you didn't say you were going to, you just said, I would prefer that
you will. <so.
laughs> You said, I would prefer that you present it as more a theory than absolute doctrine. And that's exactly how I present it. And I said, this is the direction I lean. Here's why. I mean, I even said to my class, but I went to Pastor Gary and I talked to him first. Yeah. And he asked me to present it in this manner. There was not one issue, not one eyebrow raised. It was an area where you and I could respectfully, we'll call it disagree. I don't call it a disagreement. I don't view that as disagreement. It's just a different interpretation.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything absolutely doctrinal that would destroy either our perception of salvation at all. Right. It was a minutia. So to me, that is an absolute perfect example. You're the pastor. I wanted to make sure before I do it, I'm not trying to walk in contrary to what our church teaches. And I've never really heard this presented from the pulpit. So it's not like I'm going up saying, dude, I don't agree with that. Right. It was just saying, hey, this is something that I know can maybe there's some people that fall on different sides of this. What's your angle? Yeah. And once you said that, I totally respect that. So because I understand, you know, because there's another side of this, which is a whole different podcast, but we have churches in the States who can't fellowship with each other over stuff that you really can't prove biblically. You might feel like you have a strong argument, but it's
right.
You know, we hear so much about separation. When I read the New Testament, I think the one thing that really impacts me is that the world will know that we're his disciples by our love for one another.
Right.
I'm not confessing anything here, but can you have love and fellowship with a brother who one is pre-tribulational and one's mid-tribulational? Can you still have, is that really a deal breaker?
All right.
And it's funny because the same verses that are used to prove one are often used to prove the other.
Yeah.
And I'm not declaring that I'm mid-trib here. All I'm simply saying is, why do we abandon fellowship over that stuff where we could sit and argue it into whatever?
Yeah.
Why actually do it when we recognize the priesthood of the believer? Why did we You understand what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah. Why don't we push people to dig deeper and not force them to have to come to our conclusions, but realize they're ultimately not responsible to me for their final conclusion. They're responsible to him. And what's my job as a disciple of Jesus is to make more disciples of Jesus. I'm to make them to follow him, not me.
Right.
If people walk out of Semca and they're a carbon copy of Jason, I've failed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I almost kind of welcome the uncomfortable moments where we have to talk mm-hmm. through something and maybe they don't come to the same conclusion. I kind of welcome those things.
Yeah. Well, what will happen there too, though, is both people are growing. It's just like discipleship and a true transparent discipleship. You're growing. And so I think what you'll find, and maybe I'm being presumptuous here, but I think that years down the road from now, there will be influences of Jason that's kind of rubbed off on me and kind of got incorporated into my thinking, into my vocab, in the way I do things. And maybe there's a little bit of Gary somewhere that rubs off a little bit and is top, where we wouldn't have, if we had not been brought together in a team atmosphere and be able to work together for common cause and have a common unified heart. We wouldn't have had that. We would have just stayed in our own way.
Do you want to hear something funny, Gary?
What's that?
I'm not going to say it's dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
Yeah.
But as I sit and listen to your preaching and I'm sitting beside my wife, sometimes I lean over and I say, hey, Gary and I just talked about that on Friday.
Yeah.
During podcast. Yeah. There's an influence back and forth on both of us. You've challenged my thinking on things. Yeah. I've challenged your thinking on things. And but neither of us is walking away saying, well, I'm tell you what, bud, it's my way or the highway. You know, we treat the seminary kind of as a separate entity to a certain extent. And I don't come in just like you don't come in and say, well, I'm the pastor and I'm going to tell you one thing. I don't come in and say, well, I'm the seminary director. Let me tell you a thing or two. Neither of us, because our goal is the same.
Right.
Our goal is the same. And so I'm not threatened by you and you're not threatened by me because we understand maybe we take slightly different ways to get there. Our personalities are different. The people we're ministering to are different.
That's true.
You know, you're a small group. You got families with kids. You got families that don't have tons of time to pour into. I got university students can, while I'm teaching, they're texting each other and you know what I'm saying? So, you know, and then they come over to my house on a Wednesday to eat soup and watch Lord of the Rings. You know, it's just so it's just a different dynamic. And because of that, but you're not coming to me saying your meeting needs to be an hour and 15 minutes and done. And I'm not coming to you saying, dude, what's up? You need to have a 4.5 hour meeting every week because you know, it's just, we respect each other in our lanes. And I think so going back, if you can't trust your deacons and you can't, then I say, you've got some discipling to do.
Yeah.
You got some discipling and preparation you need to do because second of all, you have to ask yourself, whose kingdom are you building, your own kingdom or God's kingdom? Maybe you didn't do it intentionally, but do you really want people to be spiritually codependent upon you, or do you want them to teach them to hear from God and be obedient to him? In that, sometimes that involves some confrontation because sometimes people need to be brought back in and guided back in. Not always is it doctrinal issues. Sometimes it's philosophical issues. Sometimes it's a play out. Bad example, but good example. In Venezuela, you know, we would to do baptism. It was once every 2 or 3 months we did baptism because we had to rent a pool. We didn't have a baptismal, so we rented a pool. Well, I didn't make a big deal about what people brought because people were pretty conscientious about their clothing until we had a 15-year-old girl who decided that she was going to wear a bikini. So I didn't impose a dress standard on everybody until we had to deal with that issue.
Right.
Then we dealt with that issue and it was over with. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, I didn't run around trying to manipulate and control everybody. Okay, we had a moment that went out of what probably was appropriate for the group. Let's address it in a very kind and respectful way. And then we just moved on. Never was an issue. Never was an issue. We dealt with it when it happened. We didn't single her out and be like, you know, because we want to teach people to be discerning on their own. We want to teach people to learn to listen from God.
Yeah, and life is messy. And so if I think that sometimes we want everything very controlled. So we just know what the outcomes are and we can control people step by step. It's easier in some sense to lock myself into a study and just, I prepare for Sunday morning, I prepare for Sunday night, I prepare for Wednesday. Boom. Not a whole lot of moving parts. You come, we have somebody that leads the music and then I give the lesson. It's inherently more messy. To empower a whole bunch of people to go out and instead of Wednesday night service, they're having small groups And because now you got to, well, what are they doing? Well, yeah, I mean, you got to touch base. You got to know kind of what they're doing. That requires a little bit of follow up. But what's stronger? The fact that we've got all these small group leaders out there that's preaching the word guiding and teaching in a small group. And now they're being equipped. We've got more people equipped than just me. So what happens if Gary goes down? Gary goes down, we've got lots of people out there that are teaching. I think you did a really good job summarizing. I should have just stopped right there and said amen and let's wrap this up. but what I'm trying to get back is just empowering others around you in your ministry to have these conversations and have space that's created in the church calendar so that people can get together. And when you, as a pastor, when you see the beauty of that, your impact is more because you're still steering north or whatever. You're still charting the course, okay? And you're still coming to the pulpit and you've got burdens on your heart that, you know, this is what our church needs to hear right now. I mean, when Pastor Carlos and I were talking the other day, you know, he really had this burden for Colossians. And he said, you know, Colossians is gripping me. And so I said, great. I said, well, I'm going to be absent for I've got a trip coming up. I've also got vacation. I said, why don't you build the outline of Colossians? You do it. He's our, assistant technically. And so he builds the outline of Colossians. He lays it out and says, well, could you preach on this Sunday? You'll be there. And then can you preach on this? Sure, I'll do it. So the building of Colossians was Pastor Carlos's idea, empowering him to be sensitive to how God is working in the church and what do they need to hear from that pulpit piece, from that corporate worship piece. But outside of that, there's a small group piece.
Right.
Outside of that, there's a discipleship piece, and this all works hand in glove.
Well, I guess just how you define success. Is success having everyone under your control and obedient to you, or is success... Because there's times when you do it, when you're not on a trip and he's still in the pulpit, where you can sit down in your seat and you can look up who's on the pulpit preaching and realize that has, you started off discipling him in the beginning. He was in a Pentecostal church. You discipled him. He wanted to be discipled. You poured your life into him. And now he's pouring his life into others.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't say, I wouldn't say I discipled him, but I was there for mentoring.
Okay, let's even just call it mentoring. I'm okay with that. The point in that being is, to me,
there was intentional relationship, though. Yes.
Our theme in SEMCA is making disciples who make disciples.
Yeah.
To me, that is the pinnacle of success.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to call it mentoring, you want to call it discipleship. You made a disciple. You poured into him. You helped him. You helped him go from being dependent for his spiritual food to now he's spiritually independent for his food. He can hear from God. He can provide, but he knows where to go to get fed.
Yeah.
And he knows what to eat.
Yeah.
Well, you've helped him through that process, and now he is doing that same thing with other people. To me, that's the picture of success. Flip side of that, when you look at the other, when you were saying when everybody has to be in line with you and everybody has to do exactly, there's such a danger in that, because that is what isolates a pastor that from his people. And here, there's really two detrimental things that happen in that. Even though a pastor may have good control, he actually feels distance from his congregation because he also feels this necessity to be perfect.
Yeah.
His family's got to be perfect. He's got to be perfect. He's got to, in other words, he has to kind of hold the line. He's got to make sure everything's done just right. And so that's a big burden that's not even in the pulpits everywhere. But there's also danger in that too, that when there's no other people that maybe can push back at him or be kind of that iron sharpening iron, then all of a sudden, everything that he thinks comes directly from God, and he can be errant in that when there's not people to help keep the pastor accountable. And that's where the book Dangerous Calling from Tripp really comes in excellent. So here's what it is. Church sets a pastor up for failure, really, because they're not helping keeping him accountable. They're not helping walk with him. The church is not discipling the pastor. He's just the one that makes all the pronouncements and runs the show. Well, then there comes a point where maybe he's errant. Maybe things are going on that shouldn't be going on. Or maybe he just has a wrong view of something that needs to, that he needs to be challenged on. But nobody's going to challenge him because he's the pastor. Uh-huh. But he's so isolated. Now he's struggling, but he can't go to anybody because he can't destroy this picture of perfection that he has, because he has to be the leader. He has to be this, he has to be that. And so nobody's there to walk along with him and go through a difficulty, maybe a thought life or something that's going on, temptation that's going on. It doesn't even have to be anything sexual. It could be money. It could be something. Uh-huh. All of a sudden that pastor fails. And what do? They run him out of town. Uh-huh. Nobody walks along with him and tries to restore him. Hey, maybe biblically by the requirements of what a pastor should be, he can't fit that office anymore. But if you just shove him out to pasture and never try to do anything to help restore and whatever his family, if he's truly repented, I think you got to do everything possible to help restore his spiritual life if he's willing to. And I think that's the sad ending of this, is that many times there have been many pastors who have fallen because they're so isolated, because the traditional, or maybe pride, whatever that's fueling it, they have to do it this way, and they've got no one walking with them, and they're struggling, and there's no one to help them through. And then the minute they mess up, they're gone. Get them out of here. Let's get somebody else. I think that's the sad end. I think
it is. And you see people, or if it doesn't, they end up burned up. They feel used up. They feel abused, and it just ends with a, sometimes you'll see these guys, bitter old guys that's dedicated to the ministry. And at the end of it, it's basically, they may not say it, but their attitude and spirit about them is, it wasn't worth it.
When I hear a pastor falling, I say two things: shame on him, shame on the congregation. Not always is the fault so easy to define, because if he's being secretive or whatever, shame on him.
Right. Yeah.
But there, let's be honest, there's a failure of accountability in love.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? We tend to look at accountability as fill this form out and send it to me. Right. Accountability is, I love you, I'm hanging out with you, you're my friend, and if I know you're going through a moment, I'm gonna walk through it with you. That was just backwards. But anyway, I'm going to be your friend. I'm going to love you because you're my brother in Christ, and I'm going to help you through this, rather than, you know, well, you need to be this because this is your office. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think that really leads us into another podcast. And before we lose it,
we better stop it right here.
I think we should stop it right here, because I think we've touched upon this before, but I think it's good to just reiterate the importance of healthy structures for pastor. But back to the original point of this, and because this is part of that, it's just an extension in that direction. I think we have to understand, again, we have to go back to, what are you trying to do? Okay, you're trying to bring people to spiritual maturity, right? You're not trying to, the ultimate goal is not that people are most faithful to all the programs in the church. That's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is they have Christ formed in them. So then you ask yourself, so how's that going to happen in our process and our context? And what is healthy, is empowering people to be able to do this outside of the church congregation. There's a place, there is a peace, we're agreed, you gather together. Hey, you've spent millions of dollars building that auditorium and building those today. Okay, I'm not saying sell it and give it away. Now, actually, for some churches, maybe they could downsize. But I'm not saying that. I'm not anti-facilities and anti-building. That's great. You can come together. I agree. But you also should empower people to actually live their faith outside the walls of that church, and actually to get together in homes. Now, in some contexts, home sense isn't a thing. They need to go to a coffee shop, or they need to go to the church.
I think there's a cultural element. Yeah.
Culture and the demographic. The point is that you empower people to be able to grow in their faith without it being, no, the only one they can hear from is the pastor.
Yeah.
You can't be afraid of empowering people, because just like back to the football illustration, if one coach has to run coach every single thing, he coaches the coaches. And as a pastor, I would encourage you to think of that. You coach the coaches,
yep.
And allow them to help build the team. And then you actually, the great thing on the great teams is that they have coaches within the players that are on the field. Now, again, it's not a perfect example, but the bottom line is, the more people you empower to be able to to go in that direction that you're going as a church, you're actually stronger. You're not weaker. You're stronger.
Right, exactly.
So anyway,
that's and fine. The way I would wrap it up from my side is say simply this: when I look at ministry, it's kind of funny how ministry to me used to seem more complicated than it is now. My job, whether it's a missionary pastor, whatever it is, here I'm a missionary. I'm a leader of the SEMCA seminary. I am to make disciples, not of Jason. I'm to make disciples of Jesus. At some point, just like a parent lets their kids grow up and move out of the house, that is the point of discipleship, is to bring a disciple to maturity where they can. So how do I do that? Just like you said, that might change. If you're in a little country church, maybe you just go rent the pavilion and y'all go down there and just have a good old picnic and talk about Jesus. And that's your small group.
Yeah.
And if you're in the city, it's you know, you're going to go over to the bakery or the Starbucks and you're going to go hang over there and everybody's going to get their skinny lattes and with oat milk and, you know, whatever the case may be. I'm joking.
Right.
Make it work for your context.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But make sure you're making disciples of Jesus and not disciples of Gary, not disciples of Jason. Because when I stand before him one day, he's not going to ask me how many people I had that came to my church and sat and listened to my preaching.
Yeah.
The Matthew 28:19-20 is very clear. I am to make disciples.
Yeah.
That's my job.
Yeah.
How are you going to do it? Mm-hmm. That's it. I'll leave you with that thought and we'll catch you next episode.